Keywords, Volume 2, by Chan Master Sheng Yan. Life in a Chan Monastery, from Chan Newsletter, number 92, May, 1992. University of Toronto, on October 18th, 1991. There really are no authentic Chan monasteries in America. You can't visit one here. To find an authentic monastery, you must go back to the China of the past. In ancient Chinese monasteries, a practitioner's time was divided between meditation, attending Dharma talks, and daily work. Morning and evening were spent in meditation. Daytime was for working. We are somewhat ignorant of the daily schedule in early Chan monasteries before Master Bai Zhang, but from the Song Dynasty onward, we know that there was chanting and reading of the sutras, as well as meditation in the morning. Likewise, in the evening, there would be some chanting or reading before meditation. In his Platform Sutra, the sixth patriarch, Huineng, emphasizes the importance of daily life rather than meditation. His disciple, Huairang, continued this emphasis on daily life. But before Huineng, both fourth patriarch Daoxin and fifth patriarch Hongren specifically mentioned sitting as an important method of practice. And after Huineng, Bairang, in his Pure Rules, mentioned sitting as important practice. Thus, sitting meditation became one of the major methods of practice in the Chan tradition. Again, in the Pure Rules of Master Bai Zhang, there is no mention of a Buddha hall for performing prostrations, but a Dharma hall for listening to lectures is detailed. At that time, chanting sutras and performing prostrations were considered less important than listening to the Dharma. From records and stories, we know that Huang Bo, a disciple of Bai Zhang, taught prostration. There is, for example, a Gong An, Japanese, koan, of a Tang Dynasty emperor who, before becoming emperor, spent some time as a novice monk at Huang Bo's Chan Monastery. His curiosity about prostration when he encountered the master performing this practice is duly recorded. Once we reach the Song Dynasty, there seem to have been both Buddha halls and Dharma halls. The Buddha hall was used for chanting sutras and liturgies, both in the morning and in the evening. Were Dharma talks given regularly? That does not seem to be the case. Within any given month, Dharma talks were scheduled rather infrequently. We don't know which days were specifically designated for them. There was also an important practice called universal invitation. This was a time when everyone was invited to do work at the monasteries. This was sometimes called Chupo, literally, going to the mountains, but it did not necessarily entail field work. It might include various chores around the monastery. Under certain circumstances, attendance at Dharma talks might be excused. Attendance at universal invitation was mandatory for monks and nuns. Huatos and Gong'ans became the principal means of practice in the Song Dynasty. However, in the Ren Dynasty, many practitioners adopted the method of reciting Buddha's name. Since Chan was transmitted to Japan mainly during the Song period, this method was not adopted by the Japanese. Often, people do not realize the influence of Chinese Chan on the development of Japanese Zen. For example, Master Dogen's The Rule of Zazen is really taken from a work by a Song Dynasty Chan master, Chang Lu Zongzi, with only a few words changed here and there. Master Dogen never explicitly said that this was his own work, but many people take it as such. Fortunately, much of the Song tradition can be seen in modern Japanese temples, both Rinzai, Chinese, Lingji, and Soto, Chinese, Cao Dong, especially Myoshinji and Eheiji. Temples such as these no longer exist in China. Establishing a monastery was never easy. Land and buildings had to be donated by wealthy individuals, or officials, or the government itself. Typically, the monastery grounds would include a field cultivated by the monks. Some temples had fields quite far off which were donated by people who attended the temple, but who lived at some distance from it. These fields were often leased because there was not enough monks to work them. Working the land was simple in the early monasteries. Later on, with the increase of donated land, leasing became common, and some monks took on bureaucratic functions and had to work in the temple office or see to the management of the land. When I left home, the monastery in which I was a disciple owned much land, so I first learned to work in the fields, those near the monastery, and also those in the mountains. Since most of us who left home were quite young, we had to learn traditional household tasks such as those learned by a young housewife. I had to make, mend, and wash my own clothes. I had to learn to plant rice and vegetables, and I had to learn how to cook them. This is the way life is to this day in my own temple in Taiwan, which is called Nengchan Si. Neng stands for agriculture. Thus, it is a place where farming and Chan are practiced together. A novice first entering my temple is sent to the kitchen to learn to cook. We also ask a professional tailor to come and teach people how to sew. But most of my disciples know only how to mend. Few can really make clothes. They don't really have the patience. However, everyone must learn how to shave his or her own head. Now we have razors, but in the past we only had knives, and we left lots of scars on our skulls. When I first left home, I was given no formal instructions in meditation or Chan. When I asked my master if he would teach me how to practice, he would say, "Aren't you already practicing? Isn't eating practice? Isn't sleeping practice? Working practice? Walking practice?" Once you leave home, you come to see that everything you do is practice. Most people who begin practice have the idea that there is a specific mode of cultivation, a specific form, a specific method. Most people usually see a physical and a mental aspect to the practice, a need to train the body as well as the mind. But when I was a young monk, there was no such idea. People saw living as practice. They did not delve into the deep philosophy of Buddhism. When I was first at the temple, we simply practiced. We worked and prostrated. Every day, we chanted and read sutras. We were not told their meaning. It didn't matter. We simply went through the process. We cut down on our attachment to the things around us, cut down on the things in our heads, cut down on our discriminations. This was a good method for us. However, for modern lay people, such training would be inadequate. Many of my disciples have questioned these methods. With no emphasis on what they think practices, meditation, prostrations, chanting, they feel that life in the monastery is not particularly different from home life. "What's the point?" they ask. "At home we work. Here we work. At home we cook. We cook here too. Why did we bother to leave home? Where's the practice?" What would you say to such disciples? Is life at home and life at the monastery the same? Someone just mentioned that it is a matter of attitude, and that is entirely correct. The way we approach life at the monastery is not quite the same as the way most lay people approach their own life. We practice not for personal gain, but simply as a way of life. Once practitioners train themselves to where their mind is very stable and non-discriminating, they must still rely on Buddha Dharma for guidance. Otherwise, they may develop a nihilistic attitude and conclude that nothing is worth doing. This would be a mistake and very much miss the point of practice. Relying on the Buddha Dharma, practitioners will live selflessly and yet be engaged in the world. Such people have a genuine concern for all living beings and work diligently to benefit others. According to the Platform Sutra, when Hui Neng first met Hong Ren, the fifth patriarch sent him to the kitchen to mill rice. And it was not until at least 6 months later that Hong Ren finally explained the Diamond Sutra to him. "Guided by the same principles, I continue to send novice monks to work in the fields or in the kitchen when they first leave home. At first, there really is no opportunity to listen to Dharma talks. Many complain about this. Usually I tell them that if they want to learn, they must do what the Hui Neng did, work in the kitchen and in the fields. To simply begin by listening to Dharma talks will make enlightenment that much more difficult to attain. Life in a Chan monastery brings the body and mind into a gentle and harmonious state. In this way, you become receptive to the teachings of the Buddha Dharma. Then genuinely practice Chan Dharma. Establishing a good foundation for Buddha Dharma in Taiwan has been a slow process. Buddhism there did not have the historical base that it had on the mainland. It is only in the last 40 years that we've had real progress. We still have much to do. However, we are working very hard to build a new monastic environment in Taiwan. We have close to 100 acres where we will build a complex inspired by the discipline and the way of life of the great monasteries of the Tang Dynasty. Of course, I have benefited greatly from the time I spent in Chan monasteries, but this was not my exclusive practice. It is because I have continued to work diligently on my own that I have reached my present attainment. In fact, two modern Chan masters, Xu Yun and Lai Guo, practiced in Chan temples for many years, but attained enlightenment outside of the monastery. This in itself would provide enough material for a Dharma talk. Let me stop here and take some questions. Question: what do you mean by an authentic, genuine Chan monastery? Zheng Yan: by this, I mean a place where people live a monastic life in the Chan tradition throughout the year. In many of the famous monasteries in China today, monks do nothing more than sweep the floor and sell tickets to tourists. In Taiwan, there are three or four places that have arrangements for people to spend time and practice, but for a limited time only. Practice does not continue throughout the year. People usually go for 5 days or 7 days, after which a new group arrives. The Chan Meditation Center in New York is similar. We have morning and evening services and sitting, so it looks something like a Chan monastery, but we have only 4-week-long retreats throughout the whole year. In traditional Chinese monasteries, there are long summer and winter retreats, which last either 49 or 120 days. At the present time, there are very few temples in China or Taiwan that provide such extended opportunities to practice. Question: I have two questions. First, what method do you teach your students? Gong An, or reciting Buddha's name? And second, what do you think of the prospects for the flourishing of Buddha Dharma in the West? Zheng Yan: first, I do not use one particular method. To some, I give a Gong An, to others, a Hua Tou. Some beginners simply use the counting breath method. I rarely recommend reciting Buddha's name, but some people began with this and are resistant to other methods. To such people, I teach a method whereby they recite Buddha's name and follow it by counting a number. It is quite similar to the counting breath method. I rarely recommend reciting Buddha's name, but some people began with this and are resistant to other methods. To such people, I teach a method whereby they recite Buddha's name and follow it by counting a number. It is quite similar to the counting breath method. When reciting Buddha's name leads them to the point where there are few wandering thoughts and their minds are very clear, I have them ask this question: who is reciting Buddha's name? This is asked continuously without interruption. That is really the Hua Tou method. As to your second question, I see the Chan practice that has evolved in the West as a stable, continuing process. It is not a fad about to fade away. The practice of Chan does not seek what is exotic or exciting. Rather, it follows a rational, reasonable, and useful way of life. I have been traveling to the United States for about 15 years. I have not really had that many students compared to the number I have in Taiwan. But those that I do have, even those who have participated in only a few retreats, are strong in the practice. Even if they don't come for a retreat for 10 years, they still remember the benefit they first received. Question: do the attitudes of the Western and Asian students differ? Do you have a different relationship with each group? Zheng Yan: yes. In fact, it seems that I have something of a closer relationship with my Western students. The Western perspective is direct, whereas Asian students are often less decisive and more prone to ambiguous thinking. Westerners are more receptive to the teaching. At the very least, they are no worse than the Asian students. I'm not trying to make Western students feel good. This is simply the way I see the situation. Question: it seems to me that the Chan approach really celebrates personal insight. It seems very narcissistic, and practitioners seem uninterested in anyone else's benefit but their own. I notice a tendency to boast about spiritual achievement. This really seems to isolate the individual. Zheng Yan: it is correct to say that Chan practice is a pursuit of personal wisdom. But how can you judge what wisdom is? Within, It manifests as freedom from vexation. Without, it manifests in the way we interact with what is around us. True wisdom is without discrimination and is always at one with the environment. It is in this external manifestation that you see that the practice is not simply the pursuit of personal spiritual gratification. If you are only interested in your own freedom from vexation and your own benefit, then you are not practicing Chan. If you practice only for yourself, you may achieve some level of samadhi, a very concentrated mental state. But genuine Chan is always turned outward as well as inward. Question. Then Chan seeks to change the world by changing the individual? Sheng Yin. Yes. Chan begins at the logical point of changing yourself. Once your mental state has calmed and changed, there is a natural tendency to help others. This will affect change in the world around us. Question. Chan practice seems quite different from that of Pure Land, but Chan practitioners still chant Amitabha Buddha's name. Why is this? Sheng Yin. First, there is a historical reason. Toward the end of the Tang Dynasty, Pure Land practice was very popular. Yong Ming was a master of the Fa Yan school, but he was also a great proponent of Pure Land. His influence was so great that after his time there were few monks who did not recite Buddha's name. It is also important to note that there is no intrinsic antagonism between the recitation of Buddha's name and Chan practice. For example, in the Sutra of Immeasurable Light, many methods of contemplating the Buddha are described, including that of reciting his name. Recitation of the Buddha's name may be considered Pure Land practice, but as it is described in the Sutra, there is no emphasis on seeking rebirth in the Pure Land. Likewise, in the Amitabha Sutra, one passage describes reciting the Buddha's name with a single-pointed mind. This can be a method of practicing samadhi. Likewise, the Sutra of Manjushri Inquiring on Praja speaks of reciting the Buddha's name and similar methods. In fact, in that sutra, the name of any Buddha will do. It doesn't have to be Amitabha. Even though all of these methods involve the recitation of Buddha's name, they do not imply an aspiration to be reborn in the Pure Land. Thus, a Chan practitioner and a Pure Land practitioner may both recite the Buddha's name, but they do so with different attitudes. Question. I am curious about what you said about the difference between left home and lay practice. You said that monks practice purposelessly. They just practice. But how can that be possible for lay people who must continually set and achieve goals in their daily lives? Sheng Yin. In the beginning, there is always a purpose, whether you are a householder or a monk. You are always seeking something. Eventually, one can go from seeking something to not seeking something. It is also possible that a person may be seeking something, yet not be seeking it. In other words, what is purposeful and what is purposeless can coexist. A genuine practitioner knows very well that the result of practice is non-attainment, but to be truly in a state of non-seeking, he must reach at least the eighth bhumi, or stage, on the bodhisattva path, which is a very high level of attainment. Even when a person reaches the first bhumi, his vow to deliver sentient beings is still in force, which is to say that there is still a sense of seeking something. Question. Is there any program in your temple in Taiwan that does work for the community and the environment? Do you plan to build another large monastery like the one in Taiwan here in America? Sheng Yin. As to the first question, this is the year of environmental protection in Taiwan. Before I left Taiwan 10 days ago, I appeared on TV with the head of the Environmental Protection Administration to discuss the Buddhist perspective on protecting the environment. In fact, my temple has been working to improve the environment for the last 3 years by advocating and practicing recycling of products and conservation of resources. For the second question, I can tell you that new complex in Taiwan demands so much of my time that it is pointless for me to think anything like it in America. But if the causes and conditions in the future seem to be ripe, we will start to think about it. Thank you very much for your questions, which were very good and helpful in explaining the Dharma.